This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, we've got a lot to talk about here this week, and also a lot of magic to talk about with our guest as well. There are a few things that I think are kind of interesting that are follow-ups from some previous conversations that we had. The first one being that back in early December of last year, we were talking with Jonathan Levitt about a new app that he was working on at the time, and he was hoping to have that available at the time that the podcast was released, which would have been prior to Christmas. It was called the Stranger. And he finally just released that this past week. And for a limited time, there's going to be a great deal on that where they're going to be offering a significant discount on this. And if you hurry and get to the website soon enough, you'll be able to capture that discount. Otherwise, you'll be paying a full retail of $99.99. But the app itself, again, is called The Stranger. Let me just say, if you go back and listen to the podcast, it'll give you some more information about it. But basically, it is a Call the Wizard kind of a thing where that any card can be selected. You call a phone number, and you have a conversation with an individual, and they reveal the card. This is really more than just Call the Wizard. It is really, it takes it to a completely different level. The best thing I could tell you without going into a lot of detail, because we don't have time here today, is go to the website, which is thestrangerapp.com. That's www.thestrangerapp.com. Go and check that out. There you'll also see about getting a discount as well as getting all the information that you want on that. It's a pretty darn cool app. I will say also that it's only available in the iOS, that is the Apple or the iPhone. It's not available for Android. Hopefully that will be eventually, because I'd like to get that myself, but I've been not able to play with it. But he showed it to me and he was working on it, and it really looks cool. So here we are about 7 months later, and it's now available. Go check it out. Also, another thing, too, is a while back that I was talking with Rocco, and Rocco Solano had told me about a thing that is fairly new, and he's going to be talking about this at Magic Live later this summer as well, and he'll be at the booth for MagicFlix.com. That's MagicFlix.com. So this is essentially the Netflix for magic. So it's going to be a 24/7 station. Well, I say 24/7. It's on demand, I should say. A kind of a thing where that you don't have to go to YouTube and try and find things. That everything will really be here, and there'll be some content that will be exclusive to Magic Flix then as well. And if you would use the promo code of Rocco, that's capital R-O-C-C-O, all caps, R-O-C-C-O, then you'll be able to get, you can subscribe and get your first month for free. Again, that's at MagicFlix.com. So go check that out. That's something new, and hopefully maybe the next new direction for learning magic. Well, as I said, we also have a lot to talk about with our guest here this week, and I captured an hour's worth of time with one of the top magicians that I've been trying to get hold of for a long time. He is so busy that I haven't been able to really corner him until I was at the 4F convention in Buffalo earlier this year, or actually Batavia, New York, and I'm talking about David Regal. David is someone that I've been trying to get on the lecture tour for quite some time, but he's so busy he just can't commit to any kind of a length of time to go out on the lecture tour circuit. So if you happen to ever get an opportunity to hear his lecture, I highly recommend it. He did lecture for us when we were at the 4F convention, but also that he shares a lot of ideas and things with us here on the podcast this week, as he also talks about the production of the Carbonaro effect, where he is intimately involved. And I know that you're going to enjoy a lot of the things he has to talk about here. And at the beginning of the podcast, I do apologize for my voice, because while I was there that I thought I had some sort of hoarseness that was caused perhaps by an allergy or something. When I got back, I found out actually I had strep throat. So hopefully I didn't share that with David nor anybody else while I was there that week. But anyhow, all is well now. You can tell my voice is much better, but at the time it was not so hot. That's why I tried to ask some questions and then kind of step out of the conversation and let David continue actually to do most of the talking here this week, unlike I've done for the first few minutes here. So I'm going to shut up and let you guys listen to the rest of this podcast. Please welcome my guest this week, Mr. David Regal, here on The Magic Word. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Hello. This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. And I want to apologize for my voice. As we're recording this now, we're out in New York, in Batavia, New York. And I don't know
Lovely
whether there's a pollen
Batavia.
In the air.
Batavia.
Yeah, there you hear that from the local radio station in the background. So anyhow, there are a lot of magicians out here, and there's one I've been wanting to talk with for such a very long time, and I thought, I'm not going to let my voice get in the way. Wait a minute, your voice get in the way of a podcast? That's what you normally do, is talk all the time. But I thought, you know, I don't always get an opportunity where I can actually share some time with you. And the guy we're going to be talking to today is a performer, an actor, a screenwriter, an author, a creator, producer.
Oh, my God, I love myself. You have to excuse me for just 5 minutes.
And he's a handsome man to boot.
I need my wife. I need to make love to her right now.
Please welcome David Regal. Hi there, David.
Hey, Scott.
I'm so glad that you're here today. There were so many things we started talking to, and I was thinking talking about, and I was thinking, hold on, wait for the wait for the podcast. So you were having a Yingling beer. You know, Yingling and Genesee are a couple of the local brews that are from up here, I believe.
Well, yeah, I do like my beer. And actually, last year I lost 10 pounds. I'm only 5'6", so losing 10 pounds is, on me,
pretty major.
Not a small thing. I've lost more than that. But
intentionally?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
And the way I lost 10 pounds last year is I just didn't drink beer for about 90 days.
Really?
And 10 pounds fell off me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that. You know, if you cut back, you know, from, I guess if I wouldn't drink my martinis regularly, maybe then I'd start losing weight then also. But it's kind of funny you said that you were talking to Roger Nico and he just...
Well, yeah, I was. We're here at the 4F convention. And this is a drinking convention. It's kind of famous that it starts kind of on Wednesday, but by Friday, halfway through, they put this like keg of tepid beer in a public place, and you just go up to it all day long, mm-hmm. and you drink, you know, warm, flat, but it's beer. So anyhow,
yeah.
you come to this convention thinking, oh, beer is in the air, and it wasn't time for free beer yet. And I was just hanging out with some magicians in the lobby. We were talking. I just sort of emoted. I said, oh, yeah. Damn, I need beer. And Roger Nico is standing there. And he's just in street clothes.
Yeah.
He's wearing, like, I think a vest. But he's in street clothes. He says, oh, you want a beer? And he reaches into his vest, and he pulls out a can of Yingling and hands it to me. And I take this beer, and it's ice cold. I think, what the hell? What is Roger Nico doing? And he's reaching into his abdomen and presenting me with this ice cold Yingling.
That's funny. And that was kind of your aperitif before you came in to drink some scotch.
And I'm not a scotch drinker, but it is free liquor. Yeah, it's proven this morning. And yeah, I mean, this is a fun convention. Mm-hmm. And I'm spoiled living in Los Angeles because we have the Magic Castle.
Yeah.
And for if you just cared about magic, all you need is that because it's like a convention every week. They change the bookings every week. There's some repeats during the year, but not as many as you might expect.
Right.
And that's really a fantastic situation. And I go to meet friends and have a drink at mm-hmm. the Magic Castle. That's very important to me. When I was a kid, I'd come home from school and there'd be those black and white movies on TV, and you turn them on, and there'd always be somebody saying, I'm going to the club. And I think, what the hell is a club? I mean, what does that mean? I'm off to the club. And all the movies from England.
I always think of Explorer's Club, you know, with lions stuffed, you know,
I had no
heads
idea.
On the wall or whatever.
When they say the Magic Castle is a club, it really is that, because you just want to get out of the house and hang with some friends. It's that. But that this convention is very much like getting together with friends. And
right.
So when we were talking about the scotch thing. It really is not about the scotch. It's about saying, kind of what have you been up to? And it's great. It really is great. And very, not to be overly dramatic, but it's a very positive, you know, feeling. It's very life-affirming, positive. And unlike some magic situations we've all been in that are very cliquish.
Right.
And, you know, have a not an adversarial quality to it, but a spirit of competition on a level, not like the magic competition level, sort of a personal competition level. And, yeah, I don't go for that.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, you really don't compete. Have you ever competed?
No. In fact, for me, and I don't it's funny. Eric DeCamps had the funniest line I've ever heard. He was doing his act, or a little piece of an act here, and he had a slip of the tongue. He was talking about the magic wand.
Yeah.
Magicians use it because it's an arrogant, elegant. And we all told him, keep that in the act.
Yeah.
That will work for lay people, too, because it pops the stereotype of a magician. But so I don't ever want to sound arrogant by saying the following. I realized early on that magic for me is this deep love and obsession, and the way we all have it.
Sure.
And I said, you know what, it's super important that I preserve that if at all possible. And so I've made my living other ways. It doesn't mean that I don't love magic. It means I do love magic because it's such a source of – it's a creative outlet for me. And when you're a TV writer and you're pitching all the time, you're essentially trying to sell.
True.
Do you love this? Do you love this? Do you love me? Do you love this? And it's exhausting. Yeah, I mean, when you go through life constantly appealing to people that way. And I said, you know, magic became for me just this wonderful world unto itself where I felt accepted and people were nice to me and I made friendships. So with magic, it has bailed me out on many occasions because when you work in television, sometimes, I guess I won't be working this year.
Yeah.
And generally it's the year you're sure you're going to be working. And magic has really helped me out at times when I did need a financial boost, and I've always been grateful for that. And it's one of these things. You know how when things work out in life, you go, you sort of lean back and go, that worked out.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I wanted to move to L.A., magic lectures paid for that move. You know, I was leaving a job, kind of a normal job in New York, to no job.
What were you doing? Anything in entertainment?
Well, yeah. I was with a comedy group for many years, and that was a regular job. But then I got hired by an interactive TV company, and they had an IPO, and they had offices in Rockefeller Center. And I enjoyed that job a lot, but like any job, they started hiring people that nobody liked, not just me, nobody liked them. And I said to my wife, I don't know if I can, deal with this. I know if I wait longer, I'll make, some money when they have this IPO, but I can't handle it.
Yeah.
And she was very understanding. And I snuck out to L.A. to pitch TV ideas.
That's
and
a
I made
long
up
way.
Lies. I snuck
New
out.
York, LA.
I made up lies. I was desperate to leave this job. Huh? I made up lies about visiting my ill mother and blah, blah, blah. And I'd sneak to L.A. and I'd pitch. And I landed a pitch, which I don't know if you know this. More often than not, you don't get money when the production company says, "Yeah, let's do this." They will commonly pay you a very small amount or nothing, a free option they'll call it. But they will help shepherd the show. They will put money into developing the show. They will pay for like a pilot presentation and then or whatever is necessary.
But they don't distribute it or anything.
Then you pitch to the broadcaster. They're the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very common if you have an idea, you go to a production company, you get them interested, and it's generally not a lot of skin off their nose. And then together you go to the broadcaster.
So they go with you then?
Well, yeah. I mean, they give you the imprimatur of professionalism. Like, we can make this show.
Right.
Yeah,
and they also know the right people, I guess, to kind of get you those meetings.
Yeah. I mean, if they're a good company, they mm-hmm. can get a meeting. I mean.
But I would think if they start pitching some things that haven't been working for a while, that they're going to maybe be down the list before that somebody calls
true.
Them back.
That's true. It's like everything.
Yeah.
It's
need to connect with the right people and over there. And so when you were pitching that, was there something then that finally clicked and you thought, okay, I'm going to make the move. This is – something's working for me right
well,
now.
Well, this is just a very common story. So it's not time to say, this is a sad story that happened to be or no one else. But it stayed in development for a year. It was going to go to do a pilot on a Wednesday. And it was like a pilot presentation, which means not as fancy as a real pilot. And I'd get a little bit of money. And for that year, I was just living off savings from the job I had left. And on Monday, the guy at the company, Tribune Entertainment, got fired.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, when they fire someone, they don't say, but we're going to keep all the things he was working on.
Anything he had, anything he touched is gone.
So on Monday, that all fell through, and my manager at the time felt it would be ungentlemanly to ask for the money that I hadn't been paid. I hadn't paid nothing. But for that year, we were talking to hosts, and we were doing casting, and they were pregnant with it in that sense.
Yeah, they're moving
but
along.
None of it went to me. I mean, okay. It was just to sort
there was
of
something you could see something at the light at the end of the tunnel, though.
Yeah. So after that, you know, I panicked and all that, but it made me make other calls, and I eventually got to meet with a guy who knew me from the comedy group, even though I didn't know him. And we had lunch, and he said, "Write me a spec script," and I did. And he gave me, like, what they call it, a baby writer job. You know, the lowest level you can possibly hire a writer on a network show. And, from there you bite, kick, and scratch and just try and stay in the game. And that's
but were you working on your own, like, at your house? Or did you have, like, a little bungalow or someplace with some other writers? Or?
Our house was like a bungalow. I mean, okay. We were renting a little place in Burbank. But, you know, I had a wife and two young kids.
Was she working, I assume? And
At that time, no. I mean, my wife took 18 years off when the kids were growing up. I think she owes me 18 years on the other side, but she doesn't agree. So it was like what happens to everyone when they make a change, I imagine. You know, you go through a certain amount of, did I do the right thing?
Right.
Oh, crap. And I was ashamed to tell people that I was, you know, a little worried, and I didn't want to look
unsuccessful.
Not just unsuccessful, but yes, unsuccessful or like a loser.
Sad.
And that was the biggest mistake of my life.
Really?
Because think of Los Angeles. Everyone
is in the same
has,
boat.
Has experienced that. Huh. Every single person. But I didn't know that yet. I was much younger.
Huh.
And I was ashamed of the fact that I was having trouble or that the show, you know,
wasn't being picked up.
Yeah. And, you know, that happens to everybody. Everyone that's in the game has had that happen. It's impossible that it hasn't. So, yeah, that was a big
But you had to learn to deal with being turned down at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's true for a lot of us. I mean, when you're in a sales job and writing, if you want to pitch your own stuff, it's sales in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn interesting lessons.
And what's the biggest lesson?
I'll tell you a couple of lessons. That job I hated had a guy that told me some very interesting things. The guy no one liked, well, it came from the world of sales, and this was a television job for him. And he rubbed everybody the wrong way, but he would sit me down because, you know, I was like a young executive at this company. Can you believe that? And he'd tell me these rules of sales. And even though I didn't get along with this guy personally, I remember what he told me time and time again. I'll tell you three things he said. One was, if you've sold, stop selling. And it sounds crazy, but what he meant was, you reach a point in a conversation with someone when you have made that sale. You can feel it in the room, or the guy said, yeah, or you've made that sale. Shut the f*** up.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes you can go a little further and you say one little detail that you know is not really, you know, that material a fact. It could be something easily removed. But they'll hit on that and they can't drop it and it'll kill the whole thing.
Yeah.
So once you've sold, stop selling. Because not everyone's like you. Not everyone's creative and realize, oh, this thing you mentioned in passing is not mandatory.
Right, you know? Right.
They feel it's part and parcel. And that's you know, it sounds ridiculously simple to say that, but it's actually, I feel, an extraordinarily deep lesson. And the converse of that. And by the way, I believe in the converse of that, and he taught it to me, though it's never paid dividends for me, it seems wise. He said, if you lose a sale, do something. Meaning, you're already at the lowest point. You can't go lower. If you do something, at least you have a chance of improving your status. So if you've lost a sale, do something. Call the next day, say, oh, I had a different idea, or, oh, you know what? I think I have a solution. Do something and see if it changes, which I thought
is that kind of like getting back on the horse again or something?
He means try to save that particular sale.
So go back to the same client again
that
from a different angle, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do something. I've sent gifts.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I've done everything. And, you know, so maybe it has given me dividends I don't know about. But it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can't make a situation where you can only make it better. And the last thing he said, and maybe I'll give you two more, because I love these things he taught me. And this is about group work. These next two are about group work. For me, that's the hardest part of the business I'm in, is the group dynamics. When people misbehave, maybe it's because I'm older now, I have no patience for it. Do not misbehave. We're all, and you know, I've said to people, when they're ruffling others' feathers in a group, and I say, "Here's what you're doing," and they always say the same thing. It's like, "Oh yeah, I just want to do a good job," when they're actually misbehaving. And I say, "Yeah, I know. You want to feel like you're doing a great job and you're contributing. But look around you, because everyone else feels exactly the same way. And you can't take that from other people. Everyone deserves that."
Right.
So the two things about group work that this guy, this salesman, taught me, bad news needs to travel fast. In other words, it's sort of like when I was saying, gee, when I lost that one sale, and I didn't want anyone to know.
Mm-hmm.
When in a group dynamic, if something bad happens, even if it's your mistake or the president of the company died, whatever bad happens, tell people, because you don't want them sandbagged, for one thing. Also, they might have a perspective you don't have or a solution you don't have. But you can't begin that process of exploring a solution if you keep that news to yourself. All you're going to do is cause harm in that dynamic.
And they're going to find out about that anyhow.
Well, yeah, it should travel fast.
So you might as well be the one to get in front of it and say it yourself.
And the last thing he said, I didn't understand at first, because we had to build a team for this company I was working for. So it was a new TV company, and we had to build an entire staff. And he said, "David, you don't want crooked people." And I thought he meant, people that steal reams of paper.
Right.
And he realized I didn't understand. He said, "No, David, there's people who go about life in a straight line. Those are the people you want. What you don't want are people that are going some weird agenda, zigging and zagging because they have this, plan here and that plan there, and they're going to manipulate the situation to cause that situation." He said, you have to weed those people out. And truer words were never said. And when I'm in a group dynamic, I can smell them.
Really?
Yeah, I won't talk about this particular job because I do not want to name names and whatever.
Sure,
it's just,
of course.
People could if I, figure things out or intuit if I said the name of the show.
So the people who were on your team, basically, you want to make sure they're going to be a straight shooter and they were honest with you and they weren't talking behind your back or trying to.
And some of these people that are, crooked, smell great. I mean, they have a lot of friends.
Yeah.
But it's funny because you can almost put a line. Here are the people they can fool. Here are the people that aren't fooled. And it's just happened, to say more than once is an understatement. In TV writing, the benefits of being a successful TV writer at the top are the biggest benefits in show business. I mean, people don't realize that. At the tippity top of the pyramid, which is not where I'm at. I'm always been a working man, in the middle and working on different shows. Some are good shows. Most are not good shows. If all shows were good, we wouldn't need to keep changing the shows. But in a group dynamic, some people just have a sensitivity to it. And I have to admit, I'm pretty good at that.
And are you talking about like in the writer's room?
In the writer's room. I mean, and sometimes it's overt. I mean, people will literally steal another person's idea, leave the room, and tell the boss it was their idea. And you think, no, that's crazy. How could they think they'll get away with it? They do it. They do it. And they even know other people will find out. They just do it. And it sounds insane. But,
it does.
See that in magic. We see that in magic all the time.
Well, yeah.
We complain about it all the time. So it's just a corollary.
And we were talking about things that John Cornelius and Steve Dushek had stolen from them, and so people do it. Yeah.
I know. That's a sad, sad story. Mm-hmm. I didn't know John well. I was a huge fan of John's, as we all were, because, his contributions were superlative. I mean, so great that just hearing that he had a new thing on the market got people excited.
Sure.
That's rare. And Steve Dushek, I don't mean to make this a story about me. This really is a story about Steve Dushek, but I'm involved a little bit. It is awful when people get ripped off, and anyone, myself included, that's put stuff out in the magic market has occasionally felt that sting. But Steve got it bad. Steve, now it's manufacturing sophisticated. When I made the Clarity Box, it was knocked off in 90 days.
Really?
90 days. And that's because manufacturing's sophisticated. When I worked for the TV show I was talking about before moving to L.A., the big boss came out of the toy business, inventing toys. So he'd go to Toy Fair, and he told me how things would change at Toy Fair because people would come to Toy Fair from a foreign land.
Oh, to steal
and
ideas.
Make a factory in their hotel suite.
Wow.
And so on Monday of Toy Fair, some toy would be introduced that was popular.
And it's hot.
It'd be knocked off the same week of Toy Fair.
And they would introduce it before the thing's over.
It's at the same Toy Fair later in the week.
Wow.
They would have knockoffs. So it's sophisticated.
Wow.
But
as you can do 3D printing so easily now and all that kind of stuff.
Look,
sure.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it, but they do it.
Wow.
Well, Steve Dushek, unfortunately, even though this, the days before the sophisticated replication was possible, he made tricks that were great and easily duplicated. Because he would look around and see what was here at the Army-Navy store, what was here in the Odd Lot store.
That was like John Cornelius used the hardware store basically as his magic shop.
Yeah. And so because of that, his stuff was easy for other people to knock off.
Yeah.
So here's Steve Dushek. I do believe I saw him at a magic convention when I was probably a teenager, and because I remember the specific tricks. And, you know, he's a good pitchman.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know him personally at all. But like everyone in magic, I knew he'd been knocked off mercilessly and he'd gotten out of magic. Well, I don't know if you know this story, but Theory 11 came out with a trick. And I won't say who they credited it to because that's not what it's about. And it was Steve Dushek's trick. And it was a great trick, a coin transposition. And maybe someone reinvented it, which is happens all the time
sure,
in magic.
Sure.
Happens all the time. And so I have nothing bad to say about the guy whose name was on it. However, I always jump to the defense of other people better than I do for myself. It's just whatever reason. I'm throwing myself in grenades for other people, mm-hmm. indignant. But when it's me, I don't. I don't know why that is. I wish I had a little of that more directed to my own self. But they come out with this trick. Not only is it a Steve Dushek trick, it's a really, really good Steve Dushek trick. And it's early in the days of Theory 11. They're a new company. And I wrote to them, hey, I saved all these emails. And my first letter was a very nice letter. So, you know, as happens all the time, you know, I've reinvented things too, but you've reinvented this Steve Dushek trick. And they wrote back a nice letter and said, oh, thanks for the heads up. But we know about it. No, it's not Steve Dushek's. It turns out it was done before him. And
okay.
I'm thinking, done before him. This is a trick. That's a really good trick. It didn't go, like, unnoticed.
Yeah, for all that time.
This coin trick. And I wrote back and I said, no, I think you're mistaken. And I got back what I considered a kind of offensive letters that were very, very sort of hard-edged.
Okay.
And that rubbed me the wrong way. Saying no, blah blah blah. Bob Elliott did blah blah blah. And I'd ask around. They said, oh no, Bob Elliott, worked at Tannins, and Steve sold the Tannins, and that's how Bob Elliott. And so it wasn't too. I didn't have to do big detective work to pop all these little soap bubbles of their defense. And why are they
right trying
what's
to defend
this
it?
Defense?
Yeah.
Well, just it's Steve Dushek's. And eventually it came down to me writing them saying. I bought the trick. I'm looking at your video. Now I'm looking at a video from 1980 whatever of Steve Dushek doing what to my eyes is exactly the same thing. Do you need to see this video? I have it. And eventually, not just myself, but some other people. I think if memory serves, maybe Mark D'Souza was one of these people. I can't remember. My memory's hazy on this. But some other people also said, guys,
yeah,
this isn't going to fly.
Right.
And I think finally they gave him shared credit or something. But, and this is where the story is. It gets sad, then it has a happy ending.
Good.
Steve just died this year. I don't know if your listeners know that.
Yes.
His health was precarious because of being knocked off. I didn't know that.
I've heard and, that. And when this that happened, true is true. Huh?
Oh, this is very true. Huh. How true is it? I ended up in conversation. You know, we became pen pals. And his wife was asked by his doctor to vet all his emails because this whole, you know, area of being ripped off just it didn't annoy him. It was killing him.
Wow.
He was being sent to the hospital with attacks. I don't know if there were heart attacks or what was going on.
Anxiety, stress.
No, this was near-death experiences.
Oh, my.
And so it's, you know, it's not a laughing matter. I mean, this guy was just really torn up inside by the stress and the upset of the stuff going on. So we became pen pals kind of maybe through that experience. I don't really remember how that started, if it was before or during or after. I got booked in a convention, maybe the Bob Little convention, and it's in PA, and I said, doesn't Steve Dushek live somewhere around here? So I called him up. I said, hey, if some of the guys want to come over and say hi, can we? And that's exactly what we did. We got into a van, a bunch of us. We go over, and there's Steve Dushek. And let me tell you, the greatest guy in the world. He was totally fun and welcoming and showing us all the stuff he's working on. And I think we all felt the same way. It's like, wow, we just let Steve Dushek be Steve Dushek when he doesn't have that as many chances to be Steve Dushek as he used to. And it was the best feeling in the world. It really was.
And he still so appreciated you coming out and visiting.
It was the greatest,
honoring him.
It was the greatest thing, greatest thing in the world.
Wow.
And like John Cornelius, Steve Dushek, he hit on tricks. I mean, look, no one has 100%. John Cornelius, he has some tricks that are just through the moon. Steve Dushek, same way. And that's with anyone that
it's creative.
On the Carbonara effect.
Yeah.
I'm very quick to say when people talk about this or that, I say, because they'll pass on a compliment, I say, yeah, the good ones are unbelievably good. And I say, we try to make everything good, but the great ones, even we sort of drop our jaws and go, did that just happen? But they're not
all
that.
It was too good to believe.
They're not, you can't mass produce things that are like that. Every Beatles song is not the best Beatles song in the world. And it's funny, I love the American Songbook, and I was reading a book about it. And this is apropos, believe it or not, reading a book about the American Songbook. And one started out saying, you know, if you look at all the songs considered, you know, in the canon of the Great American Songbook, most of them were written in a 25-year span. Because they're talking about Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and George Gershwin. And it's funny, they all knew each other, and they're fans of each other, and they supported each other. Which
is different today.
Well, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, now they actually, my son tells me, there's a lot of cooperative music groups and stuff like that.
But, that's good.
I forget why I brought this up. Steve Dushek. Yeah, we're talking about Steve Dushek and John Cornelius and the Carbonara effect. How the great ones, you can't mass produce them. And I'm reading, I read a book just about the Gershwins. And the Gershwins, you know, a lot of people consider the greatest songwriters of all time. And maybe this is the Michael Feinstein book or a different book, but it's exclusively about the Gershwins. And they said, you know, right now, when people think of the Gershwins, it's just about 25 songs. Those are the ones that people remember. And you go, really? These are considered the best of all time.
Right.
It comes down to 25 three-minute songs. And it's this... And that's the truth of it. You're talking about people who steal. It's funny. I don't want to get into names, and it's not about that. But there's people in magic who are considered thieves. And one of them was interviewed. And in his own defense, he produced a few people that said, yeah, I've worked with this guy. Never had any problems. And I wanted to call up the podcast and just say, you know, mass murderers are not judged by the number of people they didn't kill. You can't go, Your Honor. Look at the hundreds of millions of people I did not kill. You're judged by the people you do kill.
Yeah.
So it's funny that you can find three people that say, yeah, I never had a problem. It's kind of meaningless, you know, when you're talking about theft.
Yeah.
Look at all the things I didn't steal. It's just hysterical. that to me is a forest of the trees situation. So Steve Dushek's tricks that were easily stolen. The good ones, holy cow, he would sell his, he called his lecture video from the 80s, shot on primitive video,
mm-hmm.
badly.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
Primitive video badly. And you're watching these tricks, and he charged $10 for this thing. And I would say several times during this lecture, you know, f*** me. And Steve Dushek, and he sold this as a dealer's item, and but I didn't know it as that. And it was on his lecture thing, so you can make it yourself. The best four-way out for a card effect I've ever seen in my life to this day.
Wow.
Four-way outs are very useful.
Sure.
That's why people, pardon me, carry around wallets with, you know, different compartments.
Right.
And some will have more than four ways. But four ways is pretty good. Because then you can, and the card effect in a situation where they have a free choice. And you need four different outs. His solution, and I'm not going to describe it on here.
Okay.
Go look for it. He did market it for a while, but it's on his lecture video. It's a deep fooler.
Is there a name for the trick?
I don't remember what he called it. But it's on his lecture video. And I did find one at a swap meet once. I went, oh, but you can make it yourself. You know, you go down to the drugstore,
yeah.
and it doesn't cost much. And I did it at the Magic Castle for a trick. I always change. I never do the same set. And so I should say I seldom do. But I said, I got to perform this because it's just too ridiculous. And no one has ever seen it. At least at the Magic Castle, I knew no one had seen it. People would talk about it. And you do this out, and there's just, it just seems like no way.
Yeah.
Where are other outs?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. I put out magic effects because I love it. In fact, it took me a long time to understand myself. I love the process. And I've realized now, oh, I like the process more than anything. I love buying magic like a lot of us do. At this convention, you know, I buy an $80 deck of cards that I will probably never use, but I'm looking and going,
"This
is
a cool
thing of beauty."
Yeah, yeah.
And I start to realize I enjoy putting something together on my kitchen table, and then taking it to the Magic House and performing it for a high paying audience.
Right, right.
And it's not the devil that says, "Oh, look, they're fooled by a piece of thread." It's not that. There's just something about the process. I like the fact that I put this thing together. And now I'm doing it on, and I've done the stage at the Magic Castle too with things that I bought at the hardware store.
Yeah,
I just like that, and trying to deny that would be fruitless.
Mm-hmm.
I love the process more than performing, more than anything. I love the process. I love, and that's why Carbon Artifact is a good job for me because you're just always on to the next thing. That's why sitcoms, when I was doing sitcoms, was a good job for me because if you're not the boss, you're dealing with it for a week. Here's the problem. I mean, breaking the story takes a little longer, but when you're in that production week, you basically start on Monday, you're done on Friday, if it's a live audience, and then you're on to the next one. New problems, new
right.
Search for solutions, and that really appeals to me. When I was in an improv group, I loved the fact that every day was different. And what was great about the group I was in is we all gave each other a hard time. Because when you're in an improv group doing literally thousands of shows, you know certain things are going to work.
Right.
And you'll start repeating them.
It's easy to fall back on that.
And we busted each other's balls, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you brought up the Carbonaro effect then also. What is your role exactly?
I'm one of the producers of the show.
Okay.
Which
means what?
Well, it depends. Everyone has slightly different jobs. The production company introduces me as the head writer, but we all contribute. And I kind of do a safety net before the beginning of a season. Safety net goes, here's a bunch of ideas. Call it a first draft or call it starter ideas. But I consider it a safety net because it means we can go forward. If the floor opened up underneath us, we still could go forward. But then we bring in a bunch of magicians and we pitch not just on the starter ideas, but other completely different ideas. And if I were to say I have a lot of bad qualities, I can't spend all my time thinking of my bad qualities because I'd have no time to do anything else. But I do think I have some qualities that are good in the process of putting together TV shows, which is I just care about the best idea. I just care about the best idea. I don't care if, someone that's not even on the staff came up with the idea. I just want the best idea. And I will happily throw out my idea and use your idea because I want the best idea.
The best idea, sure. That's why you really want a good team of people, like you say, who are straight, straight arrows. So this way that they're, whether they take credit for it or not, you just use the best idea.
The best idea. Mm-hmm. And not everyone's like that. And so I realize you want to preserve that. You want to never start to feel like you have to shove your own stuff
for a bad reason. Is it actually the script that you're writing or actually you're developing the tricks as well?
I'm pigheaded when it comes to magic. The method and the effect are two completely different things.
Correct.
And when I say completely different, I mean completely different. Hmm. And I have a book coming out this year. It's going to be called Interpreting Magic. And I would say my last book, Approaching Magic, I would say if there was one big takeaway, it's like of Approaching Magic is, you know what? The best thing we could do is make it when we perform magic, each of us, it's not exactly the same as when someone else does magic. Because in every other performing art, no one says, I can't wait to go see that singer that's the same as every other singer. Honey, put on your best coat, We're going to see, or with a sporting event, I'm going to see that team that's the same as other teams. I can't wait. That's not how it works. But in magic, we all know there's a lot of similarity. It's like, well, no, that's the first thing that's got to go away. And interpreting magic is sort of the next step of that. I mean, in Approaching Magic, I talk about there's a lot of tricks, but it's down-to-earth, nuts and bolts, ways to make it different when you do magic than when someone else does magic.
Well, do you also work with his live shows as well?
No, I have nothing to do with the live shows.
I was going
to
say, because his live shows,
they are phenomenal.
They are.
I have nothing to do with them.
I've been to two of them, and my point was going to be just that it is kind of not a sameness about it, but, a torn, restored newspaper and, Bill Newman, some other kinds of things.
It's an education, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
But the things that he does with it, his personality, his charisma, first of all, when you bring that celebrity status to the theater, you have an ingrained love from the audience.
Well, yeah, you have a little benefit at the beginning,
yes,
but you have to deliver in a unique
deliver,
way.
Exactly, and he does.
But here's what's unique about Michael to me, and by the way, I love Michael. I have nothing to do with his live show at all, so this is a pure compliment. It's not self-serving in the least. Michael, essentially does the act he does in the parlor of the Magic Castle for 60 people, for 2,000 people.
Right.
A 2,000-seat theater is a big theater. To put it in perspective, when I saw Book of Mormon, when it was the hit show on Broadway, it was in a 1,000-seat theater. Mm. So 2,000-seat theater is substantial. And this is a little show. It's just Michael. And obviously, he has a small support team with him. But it's a small show. But
it plays big.
It does play big. And even more than that, Michael's personality is expansive. People go to see Michael. And unlike a lot of shows in Vegas where it feels canned, you don't feel you really met the personality, everyone feels they meet Michael. He feels so present to everyone there. And the everyone there is everyone.
Right.
It's people with their families. It's people on dates. It's everyone. It's the world. And they really sense Michael's appreciation of them,
right,
his pleasure of being there. And that personality of his, it just reaches out. And he's not the only one on earth who has that. Darren Brown is my favorite magician, and he has that. Very different than Michael, obviously. Yeah. Very different kind of performer,
right,
different kind of material. But when Darren comes out for a 2,000-seat audience, everyone feels his presence, like he's there. And he makes everyone happy. So does Michael. Michael makes everyone in that room happy they got in their car and showed up.
Right.
And he's a phenomenal live performer. And I don't say that about many people. I mean, it's just a gift he has.
Right.
And it transcends magic, God knows. As you said, the tricks, though he does wonderful presentations of these tricks and creative presentations of the tricks,
right,
it's this whole other level on top of that. And so, yeah, I think he's just the greatest.
Yeah, when I saw you last year in Houston, you'd come in to see a show at the University of Houston. It was a smaller theater, less than 1,000 people, maybe about 700 people or so. And this year he was at the Smart Financial Center, which seats like 3,000 people. Yeah. And that was nearly packed. And essentially about the same show, but again, the charisma just kind of pours off the stage, and everybody just wants a piece of him, and they feel like they got a piece of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He's a phenomenal performer. So it's hard to kind of separate that when he's doing the show, because when he's, let's say, behind the counter or something, he kind of has to hold that back a little bit, you know?
Well, he's an actor.
Oh,
and
okay.
Because he's a good actor, he's able to do that. And a lot of things make the Carbonaro effect work, but number one is Michael. Because
sure.
he was cast to do a sort of magic clerk
bit the Jay Leno
on
thing
the Jay Leno show.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the Carbonaro effect, started by, him thinking, well, maybe this could be a bigger show, this kind of thing. And, you know, sort of this exact process we were talking about. He found a production company, they pitched it together, and it found its life on the True Network, now on Netflix.
This is, what, the eighth season or something?
Well, it depends. Each order feels to us like a season, but technically it's been, I think they're calling it season 5 now.
What do they do, 13, 20 episodes?
It changes. It depends.
Okay.
Because, it's tough to squeeze out the amount of material we squeeze out.
In the short amount of time you do it. I'm amazed.
It's a very good team.
You guys do a great job.
It's a
and
very
Matt
good
Schnick
team.
And the other guys who are on the team.
We have a lot of good people. Derek Hughes and Darren Berger and Chad Sanborn. And we've had a lot of people.
Mention some of those names. You know, because of the credits, it goes so fast. I mean, I have to pause it just to see your name.
Tell me about it. Tell me about it. It would cost them nothing to just give us the whole second up there,
At least. Well, so name some of the people who are actually involved with it.
Well, we've used different people through the years, depending
sure.
on their availability.
Yeah.
And we've gotten some great bits from different people in Magic. And they don't all come to shoot the show. Sometimes they're there for pre-production, where we come up with the plan. We do that before we go on location. We figure out what we're doing, and we try to figure out how to do it. And it's a very practical process. We sort of divide things, and this we'll figure out in the magic room because it's like a kind of a close-up trick. And we're all pretty good magicians. And like in a good comedy group, not everyone's exactly the same.
Right.
When I think of the comedy group I was with, taking myself out of the equation, it was a good comedy group because everyone was so different.
Yeah,
everyone was so different and brought something different to the party. And I feel the same way about the Magic team. Everyone has these little areas of a specialty.
What was one of the most successful things that kind of came together, and then when you got there, it's like, oh my gosh, this was perfect?
Well, the audacious things are, for us, fascinating. And by audacious, no big mystery there. Like when we decide, can we make someone think they turned invisible?
That was a good one.
It was a good one, and really, you don't go into that thinking, yes, we can. You go into it thinking, how can we do our very best to make it happen? And by the way, the answer is not to look for a dumb person. That is not the answer. When we do these audacious things, when someone thinks they're experiencing deja vu, we work very, very hard at trying to put in these elements that will make the person receptive to that effect. Because, I don't consider the Carbonaro effect a magic show. I never have. And I'm very honest about that. And people get huffy. The production company calls it a magic show over and over and over at the beginning. Our magic show, it's a magic show. And I'd say, this is not a magic show.
Well, that's what he says at the end. It's a hidden camera magic TV show.
Yeah. And I'm just saying my point of view is not.
Okay.
I said, this show is A Strange Day in the Life of a Mark.
Hmm.
That's the show.
That's a good way.
Michael,
to
you're the star of the show. No one cares about you.
Your mark is who's important.
Well, that's the story you're following.
Yeah,
it's the story of the mark and how they're reacting to this. But why is it not a magic show? Well, we don't do magic tricks. If someone perceives what we're doing as a magic trick, we can't use it.
Good point.
In the show, they have to think it's really happening. So the fact that it's not a magic trick overtly eliminates 95%. The repertoire of magic.
Well, his presentation makes it so perfect because he gives some BS explanation as to, fumbling around a bunch of words, and people go, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Some magic tricks you can, you know, come up with a presentation to make it look like a real event in the real world. Absolutely, but most not. Most look like magic tricks. Also, we have no magician. If someone thinks Michael is a magician, we have no peace. So we have no magic tricks, and we have no magician. How is this a magic show? No, we use magic to create a strange day in the life of a mark. And that's the way I look at that show. And it's the only way I look at it. And magicians say, oh, your show will last one season because there's only so many tricks. And I think there's a lot of people, though, and no two people react the same way.
Right.
And what we're watching on one level is this Mark's experience going through what we're putting them through. And, you know, before when I was talking about the books and how the first book was about don't be the same as someone else.
Yeah.
Interpreting Magic is about exactly the title, interpreting. And using the analogy of a singer, and this has to do with the Carpenter effect too, when a singer goes to buy the sheet music, they don't go, I'm done now, now I'm a singer. No, the sheet music is the what you need to start. A magic secret is what you need to start. In other words, you're not done, but everything's so secret-driven. A lot of magicians feel, now I have the secret, I'm done. No, now you have the secret, now you can start. And what makes that not as clear an equation as would be preferable, there are some tricks, very few, that are so f***ing strong, just doing the trick adequately, like Matrix. Do that adequately. It's a great piece of magic.
Right.
People understand it. It's just so perfectly structured.
Clear.
And so there are some tricks like that, but almost none. And you have to approach magic saying there are none, because you have to. That's why the Carpenter effect goes, we do hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And magicians say, oh, but there's only so many tricks. Well, the trick is a component. It's a component to this larger thing, which is creating a strange day in the life of a mark. Well, yeah, this trick is a component of making that happen. And when you look at just the trick itself, the secret, the method, is a component. And method and effect, understanding that method and effect are completely different,
right,
is
okay,
probably the most important thing for any magician. Method is not effect. Sometimes we all want the best method.
Mm-hmm.
That's not even something to debate. Well, don't you want the best method? Of course you want the best method,
sure,
the most elegant method. And the best method for one arena might not be the best method for another arena. So you want the best method for the best place and time, for the best set of circumstances. We all want that. But you have to really separate method from effect, because when magicians say there's only so many tricks, they're really thinking only so many methods. They're not thinking only so many plots. There's a reason we can still write books.
You know, Frank Price always used to say to us, whenever I present a trick or somebody else, and he'd say, so what's the effect? You know, it's like, oh, well, that's a different way of looking at it. And Brad Henderson's a lot like that, too. Well, what are you trying to do? What's the effect?
That's absolutely correct. And another
that's
good way
the true question you need to ask yourself every time you're getting ready to do something, you know.
Al Baker's Pack the Cuts Itself is one of the greatest, or also known as the Haunted Pack, one of the greatest card tricks that can be done. I don't think anyone would deny that.
Yeah,
there's some different methods, but let's talk about methods. The effect is a card is selected.
Return to a shuffle deck.
You make your incantations. The deck slowly cuts itself. One card protrudes. The deck uncuts itself, and it's their card. Well, typically...
use threads.
It's just a thread.
Yeah.
Well, what if I had a different method? What if someone at this convention had a deck where 25 cards were hollowed out, there was a motor, it was on a remote control. I could put that remote in my pocket, activate it with my elbow, mm-hmm, and that deck is going to cut. One deck's going to come out, it's going to go back. I think every magician would go, me, this is the greatest thing. No, it's not. It's the exact same effect. It's the exact same effect. You really haven't changed anything. Because the method is the invisible part. If you've got something invisible, and yeah, I'm not saying there aren't better methods and worse methods.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's assume you've reached a good method. It's invisible. And you know, it's an elegant method. And, you know, because you can weigh methods by different things. Is it too expensive? Mm-hmm. Is it too difficult? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you feel it's too easy. It's a cheat. I mean,
right.
Generally people don't complain if it's too easy. But I mean, how are you weighing these methods? Impractical is a good one.
Yeah.
Is this practical, impractical, expensive? But let's say you have a method. If it's a good method, it's invisible. Now you want to keep talking about method? Well, so you're going to switch one invisible thing for another invisible thing. How much are you going to improve
the effect.
This effect or this presentation, whatever you're calling the end result, by switching one invisible thing for another invisible thing? Now, you might come up with a more practical method or a method that allows that effect to be better in some way. But if you've got a good method, basically you're talking about changing one invisible thing for another invisible thing. And because we're magicians, and I'm the same way, I would love to see the remote control deck with the motor.
Yeah,
I would love to see that. Yeah. But it's the exact same – that's a good example because it's the exact same effect as the thread.
Well, you know, Carol Fox used to always have ideas that were just the most simple as far as the methods go, but the effect was always the same. And, you know, David, I had learned the lesson you're talking about. I was working at Finney Bones many years ago, and it was part of Michael Finney's golf tournament. And afterwards, I did a Bill and Lemon. Well, in my effect, in my method, I had a borrowed bill, and then it was inside of a lemon, which was wrapped in cellophane. It was tied up and everything. So the comedians are all sitting around the bar afterwards. You know, these other guys were full-time professional comedians, and I was the magician actually being in there. And I said, so, and it was a new method I just used. And I said, so what did you think of my bill and lemon? He said, the bill ended up in the lemon, right? And I said, yeah, but it was actually inside of a sealed, it was, you know, and tied up. Yeah, but it was a bill and lemon. Yeah, but, you know, it was actually signed. And they said, yeah, but it was a bill and lemon. And it was they kept bringing it back to the effect. And I was trying as a magician to justify my method as being so brilliant. And they were, as a comedian, you're wanting to have the best effect to the audience when you're delivering something for them to laugh at, whatever.
Well, that's the first thing we often do when we try to improve an effect is we try and make more stringent conditions to make it seem more impossible, which is a great thing to do. And
you tear a corner or have the serial number or that kind of thing or whatever.
I talk about that in my new book a little bit. And all you can say about that is, yeah, it is a great way to try and make something better. And it works till it doesn't. And, you know, but I can't think of a more elegant way of putting it. It works till it doesn't. In other words, let's have card to pocket. Card to pocket. It's a great trick. You reach into your pocket, there's that card to the audience, the effect with that card transported itself to your pocket. You palmed it, but, you know.
Yeah.
The effect is the card transports up to pocket. Oh, how about wallet? That card left the deck, transported inside the zippered compartment of wallet. That does sound better, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's in the zippered compartment. How about card envelope in wallet?
In the wallet, zippered wallet.
He reached in, this wallet, he unzipped it. It was a sealed envelope. That still sounds better. But is it going to be better forever? It's not. Then he went to a bank vault. He opened the bank vault. Inside was a loaf of bread. He opened a loaf of bread. I mean, at some point, there's going to be a cutoff where you're not really reaping dividends by just changing the conditions. But it is the easiest way to make something better. But it works till it doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Going back also, I was asking you about one of the tricks that actually came together, one of the best ones. I'm assuming that there have been some things that didn't work and never made it to TV and just on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, like,
these are brilliant ideas and a good method, and probably have a good effect, but it just didn't work.
I would say.
And you have to sometimes let your babies go, I think.
Well, absolutely. And sometimes we have very little time to do each
bit.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. If we do the big bit in the end of the day, at the end of the episode, that takes one day. We give one day of shooting to that. But everything else, the smaller bits, we try to get four. And that's a lot. That's two before lunch, two after. So you have maybe a couple hours, on average, to try and nail it. And sometimes we end up with less. On very rare occasions, we have done more. Because just everything seemed to work.
Yeah.
But now that they want to show outtakes or secondary marks, you
That's
know,
true.
They always want us to do more of the same to get a second mark that's arable. Just, you know, so they have more more episodes.
Or the next one might be even better than the one that you thought you were going to use.
Yeah, but, I mean, this is unfortunately a problem of quantity as well as quality.
Yeah.
And so once you have it, there's a great desire to take that time, your finite resource, no amount of money buys you time. On a production schedule. Yeah. Production schedule is a schedule.
Yes.
You can buy things to do in that period of time, but that time is finite. You great desire to move on to the next thing and
right.
give that next thing that parcel of time you would otherwise spend on getting and trying another take here and there. So you're always looking at everyone else. Don't we have this? Do we have this?
Well, before we wrap up, there was something else that just off air before we began that you were talking about, a story with Tommy Cooper.
Changing
the subject
God.
Completely. I want you to kind of relate.
Daryl Rose told the story at dinner. And Tommy Cooper, you know, not as well known in the U.S. because he was a huge star in the U.K. In the U.K., a giant comedy magic star. And you can find him online. And I never met him. And supposedly, I've read about him. And
yeah.
huge magic enthusiast, as well as being a comedy magician. He would go to the magic shop and love talking about magic. Everything I read about him makes him sound like this guy I wish I'd met.
Bigger than life, yeah.
And
yeah.
speaking of bigger life, he's a huge man.
Yeah.
And he sort of drove comedy. What we mean when we say this person drives comedy, if someone drives comedy, you want them to enter that scene. We need comedy. They carry it in their souls.
Yeah.
From what I've seen,
you're talking about natural comics.
Yeah, yeah. There's just something. It's in their DNA.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm only a fan of Tommy Cooper. I have no personal story except this story that Daryl said.
Okay.
But you got to watch him online because it's corny. I mean, he wasn't kidding anyone. He knew he's doing corny jokes and stuff, but he's just supremely funny.
Mm-hmm.
Gigantic man, comedy magician. Okay, I've said that a million times. Well, here's the story. And I'm almost afraid to tell the story incorrectly because it's just I love
this. I should get Daryl to relate this maybe.
And he told the story over dinner. Tommy Cooper, apparently, in addition to everything I just said about him, was cheap.
I've heard that.
And, you know, we see that in show business for whatever reason. Famous, but cheap. So he had a clunker of a car that he'd drive everywhere. And he has to go wherever he's going to some, you know, appearance or meeting. And he's on the highway, and his car conks out. Dead. So he's in a dead car, and he's going, trying to start. He's going, nothing. Nothing. And, you know, it's other cars on this street or whatever, and he's there in the middle of it. So it's a tense situation. And behind him is a Rolls Royce.
Okay.
And it starts to beep. Beep, 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 beep. Beep, beep, beep. And Tommy's, it's like, don't, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
No one wants to be stuck in the middle of the street.
Sure.
And the Rolls Royce, beep, beep, beep. Beep, beep, beep. And this continues. Tommy's now really,
okay.
And the Rolls Royce, beep, beep, beep. And finally, Tommy opens his door.
Yeah.
Gets out of his car. Goes over to this Rolls Royce. And now they say, oh, shit, it's Tommy Cooper. Because he is a household name in the U.K.
Right.
And the window comes down. And now this guy is going, I'm sorry, Mr. Cooper, I didn't see it was you. And Tommy Cooper reaches into the driver's window, goes to the horn and goes, beep, 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 and says to the guy, how about I do this for a while and you try to start my car?
That's a good one. That's a great story. Well, listen, as we wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And first of all, let me just say thanks very much for sharing your stories and your time here.
My pleasure.
But what is your magic word? What is your phrase, not necessarily a word, like what is your philosophy of life? What do you live by? What's important to you?
It's funny. I didn't know you'd be asking this question.
Yeah.
Ever since I was a kid, you know, like 50% of everyone in America, my parents had a terrible marriage. Everyone was always upset, you know, in the house. And ever since I was a kid, I've been very driven wanting to make people happy. You know, and the family dynamic, I'd come into that mm-hmm. very tense room and try and make some joke or, you know, it's just
– yeah.
And all my life, probably from that, just wanted to make people happy. And what I think I love most about magic is, you know, people always say, oh, it makes brings out the child in people, which is absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think it's even more accurate to say, well, if anyone's ever had a baby, you put them on the changing table, and you can tickle their feet, they will laugh. And that is not an intellectual process for this infant. But that kind of laughter that comes from your guts, you don't really experience that much as an adult because you intellectualize everything. And laughter, more often than not, comes from a slightly different place. But magic, done by someone who does magic well, makes people laugh that way, or it gives people pleasure that way. And you see it with very good magicians. And, you know, they'll be performing with some, you know, titan of industry.
Right.
And this person goes through a catharsis with this magic in front of them, like sort of giddiness. You can see it in Simon Cowell, you know, on the shows he's a judge for. I don't mean this in a bad way, but he becomes almost infantilized by magic.
And
it's a really kind of beautiful thing to see happen. So I don't mean that as a pejorative. Mm-hmm. People get giddy and thrilled, and, you know, this sort of pleasure thing takes over that not only can magic accomplish, it accomplishes it in a very efficient way. And, you know, that is what sort of drives me. I mean, those moments when, you know, if you occasionally hit them, to me is like the most delicious thing about magic. It just reaches people in a way that other things do not.
So you're just trying to drive people to achieve that innocence of laughter and enjoyment of magic.
It's a pleasure. It's like being tickled in a place, you know, on your body you never knew you had.
Yeah.
And we've all seen that with good magicians. They all manage to do that. And people, you know, experience a kind of pleasure that they are learning right then and there. They have nowhere else. And they become fans of magic. And when those magicians achieve that, that's when I feel I've seen, you know, a really great ambassador of magic performing. I mean, we don't need magicians. Yeah, he fooled us, but he seemed like a asshole.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we don't need more of those. We really don't.
Mm-hmm. So tickle their intellect, I guess, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a service industry, and we're delivering that experience of mystery, which will affect different people in different ways. But very often, it's a unique way. It's not the same mystery as going to a movie and not knowing who did it. It's a sensation that's unique to magic.
Yeah. Good. David, thanks very much.
Sure.
Appreciate the time. That's fantastic. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was David Riegel. This is Scotty out.
Wow. Thanks a lot, David. That was fantastic, despite the fact that I was having difficulty getting through that, and there were things I wanted to say and to talk about, but it's just as well that I kind of sat back and let you do all the talking because you had so much to say. I hope that you guys got a lot out of that. It seems that I don't have enough of these kinds of conversations for my liking, because I really enjoy talking about the theory and the intellectual side of magic, and certainly David is one of the deeper thinkers of magic. There are a few people who kind of dance on the surface, and it's always just delightful for me to have an opportunity to really take a deep dive into magic and what it is that makes magic, I guess, and what we're looking for to make our art greater and our performances greater. So I hope that you guys got a lot out of this. In fact, that you may want to go back and listen to it again. It's one of those that you may want to bookmark and to keep and come back at some future date and listen to again. I know that I certainly will. It was really great. So thank you again, David. It's been wonderful. Well, listen, we certainly have had a great time here for these first 499 episodes. How about that, folks? And so next week, we're going to be delivering our 500th episode as I head out to Scottsdale, Arizona for the International Brotherhood of Magicians annual convention. And as I do that, of course, I'm going to be doing some daily updates from the convention. Well, the problem with that is going to be that I will start posting those daily updates on the same day that I'll release episode number 500. So shortly after number 500 comes out, we'll be having number 501, which will be the first day update from the convention. And so I want to encourage you not to overlook this episode number 500, because it will, of course, always be in the archives, and you can always take a listen to it. And my guest will be none other than the incomparable and the controversial phenomenon from Israel, Uri Geller. That's right. I'm going to have Uri Geller on as our guest for number 500 next week. Make sure that you have subscribed to the Magic Word Podcast, so this way, whenever that it comes out, it immediately comes to your phone or any of your smart instrument, however that you listen to podcasts. You can pick these up anywhere. And also, this is going to be just a really phenomenal episode. And I would recommend, if you would please, to share this with your friends, other magicians, people in your magic club, and when you're talking with others and you're talking about podcasts. This is one that's gone on, I think, just about longer than any other magic podcast over the years. And this is going to be a phenomenal episode. I really enjoyed speaking with Uri, and I've had this in the can for a couple of months, and I could hardly wait to the time I'm going to be releasing it. And so it's coming up on this next week, which is going to be on July the 11th, and that will be released at 9 o'clock Central Time in Central Standard Time here in the U.S., so be sure to tune in back for that one. Also, that if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, be sure to, or what I call the pod letter, get it? Anyhow, the pod letter, that you can keep up with what's going to be happening all the time, too. But again, if you subscribe to this podcast, that way that it's going to come right straight to your smart instrument, and that way you won't miss another episode. Well, anyhow, I'm excited. It's going to be really cool next week. I'm going to be taking a long drive going from Houston on out to Phoenix, Arizona for the convention, just because I like to drive and kind of sit and think and listen to other podcasts, see what other guys are doing too. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to tickle the intellect and deliver mystery to your audience. This is Scotty out.